This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, a Wall Street mystery.
You know, it was almost a GameStop.
Margin calls that sent shockwaves through the markets when a family office,
this guy was everywhere. It's like a perfect storm,
was forced to liquidate positions worth nearly $30 billion. We'll take you inside the resulting mayhem in media stocks.
You're going to make it too big to fail, two or T-O-O.
Too big to fail squared.
Possible cyber war. Hacks from other countries keeping tech execs up at night. Former Deputy Director of National Intelligence, Sue Gordon.
There are things the government needs to do now. They need to get on their horse and really form a focal point. Someone that is responsible for this issue of cybersecurity for the nation.
And Amazon's biggest labor fight to date. Votes are due from Alabama workers on whether to unionize. Insider's Henry Blodgett on the impact.
As a society and economy, we need to think more about big, rich companies can afford to make sure that their full-time employees aren't poor.
Those stories, plus the Ever Given, getting a little less stuck in the mud in the Suez. It's Monday, March 29th, 2021. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin, and we are watching...
Well, another week in 2021, another wild in the weeds market story for the books. This next mysterious saga described as a once-in-a-decade event. It's no GameStop short squeeze. This time, legacy television-based media stocks like Viacom CBS and Discovery, you know, Deadliest Catch, HGTV, faced massive sell-offs thanks to a surprise margin call. Here are the players. Former hedge funder and billionaire Bill Huang and the family office that manages his fortune are Archegos Capital. Also involved, banks, Goldman Sachs, Credit Suisse, Nomura. The game? From what we can tell, Archegos Capital, few had even heard of before this. Here's Becky and CNBC's Leslie Picker.
Archegos, then they told me to say it Archegos. Now it sounds to me like you are saying Archegos.
It's a biblical term, someone who's taking a leadership position. Archegos.
It all started first thing Friday morning when Goldman Sachs sent a note to clients offering block trades in several Chinese internet names at steep discounts. These included Baidu, Tencent Music, and Vipshop. But throughout the day, the fire sales kept coming. Discovery, Viacom, e-commerce site Farfetch, all offered at steep discounts. During the trading day, investors were scrambling to understand the sales and what prompted them. And ultimately, Wall Street learned that the first domino was felled by Bill Huang. Archegos has amassed massive holdings in media and tech stocks in the U.S. and China, largely through borrowed money, meaning their positions are highly leveraged. Another facet of the Archegos strategy is using swaps, contracts that offer financial exposure to companies while hiding the size of the positions and the identity of the holder. Because Archegos runs such a leveraged book, when stock prices of companies in that book started to fall, some of the firm's lenders demanded cash to cover the bets Huang made. Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs ultimately questioned his ability to even do so, prompting that stock fire sale of Viacom CBS, Discovery, and Tencent that sent Wall Street whirling into the weekend. Archegos was forced to liquidate positions worth nearly $30 billion, and now Credit Suisse and Nomura are on the hook for billions. Viacom stock was off 50% for the week on Friday. Discovery had slid 45%. Baidu was down 18, Tencent over 30. It's another demonstration of how the global market ecosystem is more fragile than investors may have believed or want.
Wall Street has been on edge. At the center of all of this is Bill Wang. He's the founder of that firm, which was set up as a family office after his own was closed. He was a part of Tiger Asia. He's a protege, disciple, if you will, of Julian Robertson. In 2012, he pleaded guilty to wire fraud on behalf of Tiger Asia. Now, all of this seemed to unravel late in the week when Goldman Sachs, which for many years had refused to do business with Bill Wang, by the way, because of those insider trading, not just allegations, but the guilty plea itself, pushed him to sell some of these stocks. He had been long and leveraged long in a very big way, especially when it came to stocks like Viacom and Baidu. Now, Viacom, as we saw last week, was hit hard in part, we should say, and we should say it was hit hard because it issued that stock midweek. And frankly, I hate to say it, I think the investor, there wasn't enough appetite for that stock.
Andrew, we know why it was up so much now. And I wouldn't blame people for not wanting to buy the stock, knowing that it was up on, you know, it was almost a GameStop advance in those things. Did the guy really make $15 billion on $200 million? Andrew, did you hear that?
He was using total we believe he was using total return swaps.
Once again, it's leverage.
Total return swaps. Yeah, it's all leverage. Something on the order of 3 to 4 or 5 times. But just fascinating to see Goldman have to make this decision. And then what you're seeing in terms of getting really smacked around now, Credit Suisse and Nomura, which were the lenders in part of that leverage,
they're getting hit
in such a massive way this morning, saying they're going to both be experiencing significant losses resulting directly from transactions with what they're calling a U.S. client that is Bill Wang. So
this guy was everywhere. It's like a perfect storm because he was in all those Chinese internet stocks too, and they're down for another reason. So all these things started happening. It's like the guy must have been like, you know, what did I do? Because it was all dependent on various things, and they all went against it at the same time.
But it was also working for so long.
The whole thing is crazy. So there's a reason you have to say you own more than 10% of something, right? Because you can get in trouble. So if you use these things and nobody knows, here we are again with, I know what you're doing. Too big to fail, too. You're going to make it too big to fail, too, or T-O-O. What have you decided? These are swaps
squared.
Again.
Too big to fail squared with a little. But let's hope this isn't that. I know there are some people who think this is sort of a long term capital style moment. I don't know if we're there yet. And
maybe
hopefully we're definitely not into
maybe more Melvin capital style moment or something.
We can hope.
It's probably why these margin calls were forced to begin with, right? Like, to prevent something like this from getting bigger. The answer was no mas. You can't do this anymore. If you look at the 2-month chart of Viacom and Discovery, you talk about these incredible declines, more than 50% in a week or something. But over the course of 2 months, this is a chart we were just looking at a second ago, Viacom's only down 2%. Discovery's actually up 3.6%. So this was a huge run-up that came back really quickly. You're right to point it back to GameStop to say, these are huge, huge moves that catch people on the top and on the bottom of these things. But going back 2 months, that's not much movement at all. So these are very recent, very rapid gains and losses.
I spoke to David a couple of weeks ago, and I was, Zaslav. And, he was doing pretty well there for a while. In terms of, I asked him whether I can use the B word about him. I actually did, and he deferred. He declined. You know, he was very modest and humble about it, but I think maybe, but he had to be close probably. Did you know that you were going to have a 70% gain in your stock?
Well, we always felt that we were a great global IP company and that we own more content than everyone else. And we've been readying now for the last 3 years to offer our content direct to consumer.
And then all of a sudden, here today, gone tomorrow with that. But yeah, that it's weird. This is not the... This is not the Reddit traders this time, guys. It's not retail. We can't blame retail. Can't say that it's any type of chat room or Wall Street bets mob or anything. This is, once again, one of the guys that you might think, what are you doing?
How much do you think, though, the Reddit trader, though, clearly played in, I think,
to this
to
as well,
the... originally into the run-up, though.
This is just straight-out leverage and stupidity.
Of Viacom and of Discovery and of some of these other stocks. And you can argue from what I understood talking to people over the weekend, Bill Wang was a bit of a kind of a guy trying to ride some of the Reddit wave as well. So we've also often talked about the idea that hedge funds
on margin,
are involved in the Reddit trade, if you will. There are people effectively, I don't want to say taking advantage of the Reddit trade, but and not only investing alongside, but as Becky just said, with remarkable margin, and then you see what happens when these things come undone, and invariably they always do. The question is what really broke the camel's back? I would argue it was actually Viacom going out to the market, looking for cash, probably looking for too much cash, and that really was
because that was a drop of like 27% that day.
Right. Where the market said, we can't do this. And I think part of that was because they went for too much. That would, you know, when you really start to talk to both the investor community that was getting the outreach from the Morgan Stanleys and J.P. Morgans of the world, there was pressure on them to buy this stuff because there weren't enough investors. And I think that was actually the tell, the tip, if you will, to so many others to sell and to short the stock. And then it created this daisy chain effect.
I agree with you 100% that that's probably what kickstarted this whole thing. But if you look at the big run up there, you know, like we say, oh, they were asking for too much and that's why the stock sold off. That's justifying the run up that it saw on the way up, which may be a little bit too generous to what we've seen with some of these things, because you probably do have some retail investors that get in there. It's hard to make the justification on the run up. Just as much as it's hard to say, okay, why are they coming back so much? This is like as if these valuations can be completely justified at some of these levels. And what I will say is this is the same story again and again in terms of money and greed and liquidity and what you see with it. And it takes you back to Ben Franklin. I was like looking up Ben Franklin quotes this morning because he was right hundreds of years ago on all of these things. Remember that credit is money. Rather go to bed without dinner than to rise in debt. You know, these same old lessons. It's all different flavors of it, but it's the same lesson learned again and again.
The cargo ship, they were looking for high tide, maybe to try to lift that. At least I was hoping it didn't crack in half. Looks better, but so bigger than the Eiffel Tower and stuck in the muck. But it is unstuck, but not completely out of the way yet in the Suez Canal. Partially refloated after successful pulling and towing maneuvers. Officials say that its course has been corrected by about 80%. Further maneuvers will resume when the water level rises later in the day. And when the vessel is fully floated, it'll be moved to the lakes area for inspection, and traffic will open to other ships, not quite yet. One shipping director told CNBC Asia that the backlog has grown to about 300 ships waiting for passage through the canal, which usually handles about 50 ships per day. And we quickly learned that it's a long way around the tip of Africa.
Cape of Good Hope.
To get to where you need to go. And we take it for granted, I think. And then you got this, Becky. This is pretty funny.
Well, that brings us, you talk about the hundreds of ships that are still waiting on either side of the canal. And that brings us to the Suez traffic report.
Suez Canal traffic report ever given, ever stuck in just south of the Fresh Food Market on 23 Jewel. Nothing doing north or south. Let's head to the north. You can see gaper delays real heavy here, especially as you get closer to Great Bitter Lake, where everyone's just stuck and bitter themselves. Heading up to the north, nothing doing here, too. Breaks all the way up to the Port Said. Same to the south, too. Suez Gulf looking pretty heavy. Nowhere going anywhere. And this extends all
the
way
up to the... That was John Hansen. He's the co-host of WCIU's The Jam TV program. He tweeted that out over the weekend and talked about how this was something that the former traffic reporter and him just couldn't resist, but it's actually pretty funny. Good play on all of these things, but no joke that this created a huge backlog just in shipping. And again, Joe, you mentioned this is stuff we take for granted, but 12% of the world's cargo moves through there. 12% has been stuck, and you are going to see the ripple effects lasting for weeks and weeks as the traffic starts moving again, and then you have backups at the ports, and then everything from there.
We did not see the...
Kind of love that.
Yeah, the oil effect was not so bad. We're about $3. Have you filled you're telling me that has not come home to roost yet? We do a lot more domestic production, maybe that's why, but it used to be, if you ever years ago heard the Suez Canal was blocked, you'd think, I don't know, wouldn't you think the crude would be up above $100 a barrel, I would think, but that did
most
not.
Most of the crude that was blocked there was on its way to Asia. Then.
Yeah, didn't really happen.
Next on Squawk Pod, state-sponsored cyber warfare. American tech leaders say it's the biggest threat to their companies. Sue Gordon, an intelligence official in the Obama administration, warns that Silicon Valley and D.C. need to be on the same team.
The private sector need to be leaders in terms of demanding that we have collective defense, be willing to share information about attacks. The government has too small a soda straw to do all the protection.
This is Squawk Pod with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Here's Andrew.
Tech executives have a new worry keeping them up at night, and that is state-sponsored cyber warfare. And Amy Javers joins us right now with the latest from a CNBC Technology Executive Council survey with some fascinating insights. Eamon.
Yeah. That's right, Andrew. We're seeing a shift in the way that technology executives perceive the threats in cyberspace, and it mirrors what we've seen going on in the news more generally. Now, according to the first quarter CNBC Technology Executive Council survey, concerns about state-sponsored cyber threats remain high. 48% of those surveyed said that's the most dangerous threat to their organization. That number was at 50% in the fourth quarter and just 20% in the third quarter of last year. So you can see how it spiked and has remained elevated since that SolarWinds hack during the wintertime last year. Now, 10% said individual hackers were the most dangerous cyber threat, and 35% said employee mistakes were the most dangerous. And these concerns are going all the way to the top. 74% said their board has had a formal discussion about the SolarWinds hack, and an additional 10% said they haven't done that yet, but it is on the agenda for their next meeting. And we asked them how they think the government is doing in responding to the SolarWinds hack. Average got the largest response at 45%. 23% said poor, and 0% here said excellent. That's not a number you see often in polling. So this is a group that's not been inspired by what it's seen from Uncle Sam so far, guys. So this is just a snapshot of what the industry is thinking. There are 31 members here responding of the Tech Executive Council. They're all high-ranking tech officers in their companies, though. Back over to you.
For more on this, let's welcome Sue Gordon. She served as the Principal Deputy Director of National Intelligence in the Obama administration, and she's now a CNBC contributor. And Sue, just looking at this, I mean, it's kind of overwhelming. If you are the head of a company that is being attacked by a nation state, what are you supposed to do? That's pretty overwhelming.
One, good morning, Becky. And I'm in a way, I'm heartened to see the tech executives. They have it right. Threats are both the alligator closest to the boat tactically and a significant strategic threat. These two last attacks show that nation state actors are willing to attack non-governmental entities as a pathway to their objectives. And even though these two have been largely about intelligence gathering or espionage, it doesn't stop there. It doesn't have to stop there. So they're right to be concerned. We'll talk about the government in a minute. You know, I'm perfectly willing to be critical of the entity that I've been a part of for most of my career. But I don't think this is something where we want to wait for the government to be good. Companies, reputations, operations, and then their contribution to national security are all at risk. And so there are some pretty clear things they need to do. Ayman mentioned one that they're recognizing. They need to have C-suite discussions about the value and risk to their organization. I'd even suggest that they exercise at the board level, at the senior level, a cyber attack. They also need to add more talent, not just to boards, to get more tech-savvy, cyber-savvy people sitting in that boardroom, but they also have to add it to their information technology teams, because this isn't just about running a network. This is about the ability to do some forensics. And finally, they really, really need to ensure that they're making it hard for adversaries by reducing the complexity of their networks, layer security controls, and know their data and systems.
Yeah, obviously, employers are concerned, and they know that mistakes that their employees might make are one of the things that they're most worried about. So point made that they need to be watching things at home and really ramping things up for some sort of self-reliance. But what is the government doing? Is it safe to assume that they are doing more things than they are going to tell us? But, you know, if we've got nation states that are attacking us, how do we go back at them?
Yeah, so one, this is hard. And it's hard because our adversaries well know that there are protections in place that actually limit the ability of the federal government to go trooping in to the private sector. So that's something that we're going to have to overcome. I really have seen in the last year, the Trump administration, and the first year, the beginnings of the Biden administration, a real focus on this, starting with the Cyber Solarium report. And now with the positioning of people in the White House. But there are things the government needs to do now. They need to get on their horse and really form a focal point. Someone that is responsible for this issue of cybersecurity for the nation. They need to set some security standards. We just don't have them. It's time to put them in place. probably need to go harder on the deterrence and response, establish some international norms, and we need to be able to get our best players on the field. We'll talk about the limitations of the private sector and information sharing, but we need to really look at how we get our best cyber defenders playing on this private sector field. So I see a lot of activity. I would say the private sector, my companies, really need to put pressure on it and need to be leaders in terms of demanding that we have collective defense, be willing to share information about attacks. Yep, Congress get in there and provide some incentives and protections. But if we don't share all the information we have, the government has too small a soda straw to do all the protection.
Eamon, you've been following this for a very long time, cybersecurity. What do you think about the risk to companies right now and any potential cooperation with government?
Well, it's higher than we've ever seen in terms of the risk, right? I mean, and the cooperation piece is still just not there. A lot of companies are just not disclosing that they've been hit. We know that thousands of companies have been impacted by these recent attacks, but we've only seen, you know, maybe dozens of disclosures of those attacks. So a lot of companies are still hiding the ball from the public and, we're told, from the government because of fears of liability, reputational damage, all of those things that business executives are going to deal with. Now, I've actually got a question for Sue, because, Sue, we saw a bunch of intelligence officials up on Capitol Hill last week testifying about one of the big problems that they deal with is the fact that the NSA, which is, you know, as you talk about our best cyber troops, you know, those are sort of our best players. They're prohibited by law from looking at U.S. servers because they're designed to look overseas only. And there are good and right privacy reasons why that is. But the bad guys know that. And they've been able to rent servers in the United States from well-known American server farms and launch their attacks from inside the United States. Do we need to either allow the NSA to look inside the United States, which raises a whole bunch of questions, or do we need to have some kind of regulation on those server farms, sort of a know-your-customer type regulation, the same way we have with banks, saying if you're going to lease out this space, you need to know who you're leasing it out to, and you need to be able to tell the government that you're not selling this space to hackers?
I think you have it about right. Number one, on the question of NSA being able to have different authorities that allow them to look in the United States, I think that is a really serious question. We need to look at it in general. I'm opposed to escalating government authorities, but we ought to look at it because it is an unfair fight that we have nation state actors attacking U.S. companies. I also think you're right that we need to get Congress to establish some protections or incentives for the data sharing. And I think one of the considerations is exactly what you said, this know your customer. This really has to be collective defense. There isn't a way for the U.S. government to alone protect this, but shared, we're not doing enough shared work. And I think that's where the government, the Congress, and the companies have got to come together.
Sue, thanks for your time this morning. And Eamon, good to see you.
Thanks, Becky.
Coming up, Amazon workers deciding whether to unionize. Insider's Henry Blodgett on the Davids and the Goliaths.
The really important larger story here is just the increasing bifurcation in the economy between shareholders and everybody who works for a living.
Squawk Pod will be right back. You're listening to Squawk Pod from CNBC. Here's Becky Quick.
Amazon workers at a warehouse in Alabama have been voting by mail on whether to unionize. The ballots are due today. Counting starts tomorrow, and there is a lot at stake. Deirdre Bosa joins us right now with more. And Deirdre, people around the country are watching, but especially in Washington.
Yes, and certainly other warehouse workers at Amazon are watching as well. That's why the stakes are so high here. Now, the results will determine whether Bessemer, Alabama workers will become the first group to unionize among Amazon's 800,000 U.S. workers. But guys, don't expect this process to be quick or smooth. The mail-in voting period that ends today, counting starts tomorrow, that's likely to last days, in part because both sides can dispute votes. There are about 6,000 workers at that warehouse, guys, the majority of which would have to support unionizing in order for this to pass. But even if it does pass, it could take years of bargaining to reach a first contract, and either side could and is likely to contest the results. Now, tensions over the union battle have escalated over recent weeks. Last week, we talked about a Twitter spat between one of Amazon's most senior executives and lawmakers that received a lot of attention. On Friday, Senator Bernie Sanders visited workers, telling them, quote, "They know if you succeed here, it will spread all over this country."
When you stand up and fight, you are taking on here not only one of the most powerful corporations in this country, you are taking on the wealthiest individual in the world, and you're doing it in an anti-union state. So what you're doing requires courage, and from the bottom of my heart, I salute you.
And guys, that idea of a domino effect is why those stakes are so high here. Labor challenges, they could push Amazon to alter its policies and ultimately threaten that efficiency, guys, that has turned it into a $1.5 trillion market cap powerhouse, Becky.
Hey, Dee, over the weekend, there were those reports that suggested that Jeff Bezos was the one who was pushing for a more aggressive response to the critics, that he maybe got people fired up about that. What do you know about that? What do you think? And where does Andy Jassy fit in with all of this?
Right. Andy Jassy, who's supposed to be taking over the reins later this year, but no one expects Jeff Bezos to go anywhere. He's going to remain executive chair. And it may be a little unusual for Bezos to sort of direct this, but it's certainly not unprecedented. A few years ago, there was that New York Times article about harsh working conditions for white collar workers. And you saw this response from their head of policy, chief communications officer, Jay Carney. He was Obama's former press secretary, came out hitting hard against it. So the report over the weekend from Recode says essentially that Jeff Bezos has been watching this and he wasn't happy that they weren't pushing back hard enough. So this was actually a mandate from him to do so. And it's got a lot of people talking, of course. We talked last week, about that back and forth. And people are kind of shaking their heads thinking, what is the strategy here? Perhaps rile up the other side, Republicans who may be against this unionization effort or against changing some of the corporate tax initiatives. But it certainly is one to watch this week as we get closer to that outcome. Again, votes, they start to be counted tomorrow. So we'll see what the Amazon Twitter handle and Dave Clark, their SVP of Worldwide Operations, is thinking about tweeting over the next few days. It'll be one to watch for sure.
Yeah. I don't know what happened here, but we've all seen it in the workplace where the boss says something and people jump over themselves to try and respond, sometimes react a little too much, maybe too aggressively in some of these situations. We've all watched it play out in the workplace, though. Dee, thank you.
Talking about what this unionization vote could mean for Amazon, Henry Blodgett's here. He is, of course, the CEO and co-founder of Insider Inc. Henry's also going to weigh in on this huge selling in media stocks related to this Archegos capital management margin call that took place late last week. But let's start with Amazon and the way you see it, Henry, in terms of what's at stake now and what's at stake longer term for Amazon.
Well, I think it's interesting that Amazon is the company that's being targeted because they have been more proactive about raising at least salaries for employees, but incredibly high profile. Obviously, a lot of people work there now, so it's not surprising. I think stepping back from it, the really important larger story here is just the increasing bifurcation in the economy between shareholders and everybody who works for a living. And I think that there have to be ways for companies to share more of the value that they create with the people who create it, their employees. And I think that that's the at the heart of this. I think for Amazon, I think they will work through this. I don't think it's devastating if a union is created, as Deirdre just said, you have many years of negotiation and it's one place and maybe in other places there won't be unions. But I do think this is a story about the U.S. economy, and I think we will continue to see more of this.
But Henry, I think going to this issue of even just how Amazon is dealing on social media with the likes of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, do you think that the strategy of pushing back on them, on pushing back on unions, is the right one? Amazon's considered one of the most popular companies in the country, if not the most popular. And so maybe they have an authentic claim on being able to push back, or do you think that that is a losing strategy longer term?
Well, I don't think the execution over the weekend at the end of last week helped them particularly. I think they do have a strong case to make, which is They led their industry in raising wages to $15 an hour. They have health care. This is something that other companies like Walmart and Target, all the fast food companies, have not yet done. They've been fighting it. They will move toward it over time. So I think Amazon does have good arguments there. And I do think that people actually do generally like Amazon. So there is
why do you think that Amazon, their
Twitter war was smart.
If you think Amazon's on the right side of things relative to the Walmarts and Targets of the world, why do you think they get the, and I don't know if you think it's disproportionate or not, but they get a lot of attention, as you know, from the left, from Elizabeth Warren, from a Bernie Sanders? Appropriate, well, not appropriate?
Well, they get what Walmart in its heyday got, which is you're destroying small businesses. You're funneling all the money now to the richest person in the world. It's just an easy company to attack that way. And they're huge. They employ almost a million people. Right. So there's a lot to gain from that. The stock has done so well. It's so high profile. So very easy target. But I do think they are headed in the right direction. I think everybody else needs to follow them. And I think as a society and economy, we need to think more about, you know, big, rich companies can afford to make sure that their full-time employees aren't poor. And that's the case with a lot of our big, rich companies.
Henry, let's pivot right now to this blow-up of Archegos, the margin call that took place last week. You're seeing the fallout on Nomura, for example. You're also seeing the fallout for Credit Suisse. Those were the folks that had lent them the money that was used in terms of levering up some of these big positions in media companies like Viacom, CBS. Curious how you see that trade unwinding, what you think the larger implications are for Wall Street, but also for these stocks unto themselves.
Well, I think it's a good reminder that there are a lot of big players in the markets who use a lot of leverage, and leverage makes you look like a genius when you're right and an absolute reckless moron when you're wrong. And hopefully this is just one isolated dice roller who got blown up along with all of his or her enablers. And it won't cascade from there. But I just think it's a good reminder to everybody that what seemed so rock solid may in fact be built on this enormous leverage with tiny actual capital.
I think the question is this the tip of the iceberg? Is this the piece of the iceberg that's jutted up above the water? We can see it now, but that underneath it, there's a lot more? Or you really think this is a one-off?
I let's hope it's a one-off. I don't know any more than anybody else. Mohammed El-Aaron was saying the same thing earlier. It'd be unusual to see a huge cascading issue in the equity market like this. Usually it's in the bond market or currencies or what have you, but possible.
And then when you look at the media companies, and I'm thinking Viacom, CBS, we're talking to Rich Greenfield about this. They raised $3 billion last week. Obviously, there's a lot of investors that are furious right now because they were buying that at $85 a share. Was it the right move long term to take that cash and hopefully invest it in the right things, and we'll see whether they do? Or was it a mistake in terms of the long term trust issue that has now been developed in this case?
The right time to raise cash is when people are eager to give it to you and buy stock. And when markets are good, you never want to wait until you actually need it, because then it's a much harder thing. Everybody who bought on a big institutional offering like that is an adult. They are very good at analysis. They can make their own decisions. So I don't think management should be beating themselves up about that. At the same time, you know, it's a good reminder. The stock has gone from 12 to almost 100 over the course of a year. You know, maybe you're buying it at the top, what have you. So again, I think it's a good reminder to everybody that stocks do occasionally sometimes go down.
Henry Blodgett with the insights this morning. Appreciate it. Great to see you, my friend.
Thanks a lot, Andy.
That's Squawk Pod for today. Thanks for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern for timeless money and life advice.
Remember that credit is money. Rather go to bed without dinner than to rise in debt.
Subscribe to Squawk Pod wherever you listen and share this podcast with a friend. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.